Thank you, Matt. Good morning, everyone. I look in the audience and I see many familiar faces and people that I certainly don't need to be speaking to on this subject. You guys are the experts, but I would like to share in the next several minutes some slides that I've put together that basically provide some overview of some of the challenges and concerns that we have related to the pressures that we're seeing in agriculture right now and some of the drivers of these pressures. And we need to, through the rest of the session, discuss and how we're going to cope with these challenges, because it is a different time and there is a different accountability now. Everyone in this room that I recognize and am familiar with has heard this story probably through several presentations earlier this week. Population's increasing. We have a growing population that's going to require more food, fiber, and fuel. How we're going to accomplish that is an enormous task. And doing that is probably going to require more fertilizer input, which raises the pressure on trying to minimize our potential environmental impact. All of us recognize that we live on this earth primarily due to our ability to capture nitrogen and make it useful to humanity. And half of that nitrogen fertilizer that we have synthesized has been used since 1985. And I cite Bob Howarth at Cornell University, who has issued this statement a number of times. And of course, friends at Woods Hole Research Center have reminded us numerous times that human alterations of the nitrogen cycle are causing a number of environmental and health concerns. Some of these have been substantiated, others are born out of concern about the potential for damage. Very recently in Science, Donald Canfield issued a report, and you see the information Science Fair that was following that report, Fertilizer Overloading Earth's Plant Life. And we understand that when we do damage, this damage does not just have immediate effect, it can have very long-term effects if we do not take on careful management strategies and try to address these areas of concern here with food security. Of course, most of us in agriculture have been focused on this, but sometimes perhaps we haven't been as comprehensive as we need to be in addressing concerns for water quality, human health, air quality, and ecosystem health, and increasingly concerns about biodiversity. Fertilizer consumption around the world has been on a continued incline. In the U.S., on this scale, it's represented as a relatively flat increase. However, when we change that scale, we see that since about 1980, there have been some slight and gradual increases, representing about a 0.5% increase in fertilizer nitrogen consumption in the year since 1980. But the perceptions are, because of biofuels, there's been a huge corn expansion, and as a consequence, a huge nitrogen fertilizer consumption increase. And I did just a quick comparison here, and you'll see in that first column there, under acres of corn grain harvested, that the change from 81 to 2008 represents a 5% acreage increase. And that change per year there for corn grain yield is 1.5%, but since 1980, there's been a 41% increase in the average corn yield across the major corn-producing states. And the total grain production has increased 49%. So we've increased fertilizer consumption 0.5% per year since 1980, but the yields have increased 1.5% and total production 1.8% per year on average over that time span. The question is, will these recommendations be appropriate for the future in meeting food demand, but also in protecting the environment? Now, there have been reports by FAO, and there are people around the world that are getting more alarmist in their approaches. Some, as this lower right figure indicates, are mad as hell that there's not equity around the world in fertilizer distribution and consumption. And certainly in East Asia and South Asia, we see consumption increasing more at a more rapid rate than in other places around the world. And in Africa, it's been indicated in presentations earlier this week that I heard that the average farmer uses 8 kilograms of fertilizer per hectare. And there's a goal by 2015 to reach 50 kilograms per hectare. So these inequities in use are related to supply-demand economics as well as social and political concerns, and are not something that people in the industry and people who are expert in advising people in nutrient management have particular responsibility for. It's a societal responsibility. And Peter Vitusek in Science in 2009 underscored some of these differences here, showing that in West Kenya there's a deficit of 52 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare per year, where in parts of the Midwest we have some surpluses. In this case, the Midwest states that he looked at, represented by Illinois, I think, in particular. Mark, you may remember that better than I, but that's a surplus of 10, according to his balance, for the years that he looked at. Now, as society improves its per capita income base, we have a tendency to consume greater protein amounts. In the U.S., you see the top curve representing red meat and poultry production, and you see where beef production has remained relatively flat while broilers and pork have increased, and then the lower curve shows our per capita consumption rate, where there's been some shifts in that the U.S. citizen is increasingly using poultry as its meat source, and less beef is being consumed, and pork hasn't changed much. But what are the consequences of that increased development and income around the world and these protein choices that would be made? And Galloway and Cowling in 2002 indicated, according to two different tracks of nitrogen fertilizer consumption and efficiencies, the top track showing basically a cereal grain approach, a vegetarian approach, if you will, rather than an animal protein approach to nutrition, and indicating that basically you have more loss from an animal protein diet approach than you would from a vegetable or grain protein diet approach. And so there are these risks and concerns. Can we manage those? One thing most of us in this room, many of you are expert at, I think, is helping farmers do a better job of improving their efficiency. We recognize the importance of the soil supply, fertilizer, and other inputs, and crop and uptake. And what we want to do is maximize crop nitrogen uptake when we apply nutrients in any form, and minimize these losses via these various pathways. And we have to recognize and help a broader segment of society recognize that all these are affected by cropping system management and not strictly the inputs and the offtakes. It's how we manage a system that I think is where our greatest gains can be made. Globally, nitrogen use efficiency is less than 50%. Numerous presenters have shared these facts earlier in the week. Doberman and Kassman indicated for cereal grains is sometimes as less than 37% globally, but indicated with good management there's opportunity to raise that significantly. In cereal crop research, on average, Doberman showed in 2007 that on most farms it's less than 40 to 50%. And in the book by Follett and Hatfield, Kitchen and Goulding indicated that we can approach 60 to 70% with good management. So how do we get from what's average to what we know is a realistic, attainable goal? Well, there are many different ways to do that, and certainly there's an EPA Science Advisory Board, Integrated Nitrogen Committee, that has generated a report that suggests that we can increase 25% efficiency from where we are right now can help us minimize a lot of our environmental pressures and impacts, and included the point that improved fertilizer technology and advances can play a significant role in this area. Now, EPA, I may have gone one slide too quickly here. No, I did not. Excuse me. Has issued on October 7th its 5 strategic goals to advance environmental and human health on their mission and their charge in serving society. And the areas in blue are highlighted here: taking action on climate change, protecting America's waters, ensuring safety of chemicals, and enforcing environmental laws. And if you, for a moment, allow me to focus on water resource concerns, we recognize that the public is afraid. They're afraid as we increase fertilizer nitrogen use. If we look at our current situations, the prognosis is not good. There's an indication that if we don't manage better, we're going to have more contamination of our water resources. With 148% increase in global nitrogen fertilizer consumption from 1970 to 2005, the data on global delivery of nitrogen to coastal waters is shown a 35% increase in dissolved inorganic nitrogen and an 18% increase in total nitrogen. And Ephraim King in the EPA's Office of Science and Technology reported at the 2009 Hypoxia Task Force meeting in Des Moines that there are at least 14,000 nutrient-related impairments in 49 continental U.S. states. And 53% have medium to high levels of nitrogen. Our hypoxic zones are increasing around the U.S. and that 78% of the assessed coastal areas exhibit eutrophic symptoms. And probably a case that I'm probably more familiar with than others is a Gulf of Mexico hypoxia area, and it's been monitored since 1985 by Dr. Nancy Rabelais and colleagues. And we saw in 2009 that the size of the zone was down, but in 2010 it was back up. The green arrows indicate years where there was some disruption in the size of the zone that did not allow us to maximally to determine the maximal aerial extent of the hypoxic area. And basically what we're seeing is here is that we're not seeing a change in the size of the zone. There has been a decline in in total nitrogen delivered to the Gulf of Mexico, but nitrate nitrogen has not changed significantly over this course of this period. Well, this is not common just to the U.S. There are issues globally. And in fact, Diaz and Rosenberg in 2008 indicated that there's a significant rise around the world of this human footprint on these coastal areas. And USGS has estimated the discharge locally and the delivery to the Gulf of Mexico. And I put these in these different units, and you see in the heartland of the country, we have some significant challenge based upon their modeling approaches. And in addition to this Gulf of Mexico watershed, Chesapeake Bay, and several of you in this room are expert in this area, and I'm a little bit out of my area of familiarity, but I just wanted to mention that watersheds, each watershed is rather unique, and our approaches to solving problems in these watersheds needs to be unique. One size does not fit all. There are some people that want to have a uniform policy, which I think is wrong and basically ignores a lot of the science. But we understand that agriculture has a different influence in many of these watersheds, and there have been different working groups that have been developed to address these issues, and action plans, as shown in the bottom frames here in this slide, have led to concerns about development of state nutrient reduction plans. Now, since 1999, I know EPA has charged that we should develop nutrient criteria. States are supposed to develop nutrient criteria based upon their monitoring and assessment. States have not moved as rapidly as many environmental groups and EPA would like. As a consequence, suits have been brought to bear. And I'll go on to that in just a moment relative to the Florida issue. But something that was very striking here, and it caught many people a little bit by surprise, was in Iowa, the governor of Iowa said that we have to acknowledge that the fact that the problem is getting worse, not better. I don't know that it's getting worse relative to what's going on with the Gulf hypoxia situation. I think that's what he was referring to. But local water quality, we have to work locally to affect downstream. But now, many people are saying downstream's taken the brunt of the problem long enough, and there may begin to be developed a process where downstream will begin to dictate what happens upstream. And the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship and Iowa State are going to be working on a statewide nutrient reduction strategy, according to data that was released October 4th. And the Department of Natural Resources lead there, Wayne Gieselman, said that commercial fertilizer management plans would be a good idea. And many people are saying that farmers and fertilizer industry should be restricted by law in what they apply. Well, let's examine just for a moment a little bit of the science. There's this common assumption that everybody is applying above an optimum nitrogen rate. And I would not suggest that everybody's perfect. But I'm not sure that people are farming that much in excess of what the optimum nitrogen rates are. Mark David's here in the audience, and I feel a little bit odd in sharing a little bit of his numbers here in his recently published paper in Journal of Environmental Quality. But his work indicated that in looking at net nitrogen inputs, those net nitrogen inputs were not a good indicator of riverine nitrate nitrogen yields. Instead, it's the hydrology of the system and the leakage of our corn soybean systems and tile drainage that complicate the loss of these nutrients. Now, that's not to say we don't need to try to tighten that balance as much as possible to minimize these aggravated effects. But we have to recognize that there are just some things that are beyond farmer control in the systems that we're dealing with now. We may have to redesign systems or shift to different systems where in our landscapes there's tremendous risk for leakage. So it requires a different strategy. That's the Midwest representation. In the Northeast U.S. and Europe, Bob Howarth shared these data with me that were unpublished. The top curve shows the net anthropic nitrogen input, and in these analyses, comparing that with riverine nitrogen flux, an R-square of 0.66, and if you look at just the fertilizer inputs, the R-square is 0.69 with riverine influx. And what Bob is doing with his analysis, he's not only looking at at the fertilizer inputs and the crop yields, but he's also looking at the transfer of grain and food into and out of these watersheds. And so it's a slightly different approach. But what he's indicating is, yes, when there's a surplus, there is a greater risk for loss and discharge to these riverine systems. Weightable stream assessments in the United States began a few years ago. Ephraim King shared data here. I have a little problem in that the scale that he's often showing, and also others in USGS, is micrograms per liter. I would prefer we stay with milligrams per liter that most of the public identifies with respect to water quality, groundwater, and surface water. But basically, you're looking at 0 to 10 milligrams per liter here. The darker circles represent higher concentrations, and you see key areas of focus in the Northeast, the upper Midwest, and then also parts of California. And this was quite an extensive survey, and indicating that we do have challenges, not just with surface waters, but with groundwaters. And I personally have more concern about our groundwater contamination, because once it's there, how do we mitigate that? Alarm over Florida numeric nutrient criteria. If you've been reading the news at all, most of you are very familiar with this. EPA has come in and told Florida that their approaches were not sufficient. EPA was forced, according to a suit, and what we see is more and more environmental groups pushing EPA and states to step up their standard development. But the problem is that they're not considering the economic cost. In fact, EPA's estimate of the cost to the Florida, to the state of Florida, is significantly lower than these values that have been generated by the Florida Department of Agriculture. And what society has to understand is we want cheap food, but we have to understand there's cost for that cheap food beyond what we just pay in the marketplace for that food. We have to consider there are costs in changing the way we're currently doing things. And I would like to see society step up and help support agriculture and our education research programs to do a better job, and partnering with industry and environmental groups and all of us working together rather than throwing stones at one another. Turf fertilizer restrictions are driving a lot of this. Smaller and smaller percentage of the public is in agriculture, and everyone in this room knows that. But some cities and counties and municipalities are suggesting that we want to control this, and so they put bans on applying fertilizer during certain times of the year and putting limits on this. And some people in agricultural areas of the country are saying, wait a minute, this could come home to roost in our own backyard. And this is what's happening politically. Now, my talk was supposed to be social and environmental drivers. I'm not going to touch on political more than that, or economic, because that's certainly way outside my expertise. But these risks, we need to better understand the risk of where we have potential to do environmental harm. And in these specific areas, we need to take some proactive steps. One of our problems is, though, is that our data sources are not complete. Rupert published work in 2008. And what you notice is, where much of our fertilizer and is used and our grain is produced in this country, we didn't have sufficient data to look at changes in groundwater nitrate over time for this period of 88 to 2004. But he concluded of those sites that he did have data for, that many were increasing in concentration, but 67% had no significant change in nitrate concentration. But where there was a change, he attributed that to an increase in input strictly from fertilizer. Groundwater nitrate in California. Rob Mickelson and I came out here several weeks ago, and we met with some people in the Water Resources Board, and certainly California has some challenges, and I just thought, since we're here in this area, that I'd share a little bit of some of their challenges nearby. The concentration shown here in the light blue, the green, and the orange circles indicate a relative concentration as presented by Landon and Fram in 2009 compared to the maximum contaminant level. And what you see is that there are some high areas there. And in fact, these groundwater concern, high nitrate groundwater concern areas, are invoking some dialogue between the environmental community and the agricultural community. But these challenges are great, because sometimes it's taken us 50 years to get to this high nitrate concentration. I don't know how long it will take to get away from that, where you don't have a lot of water to leach through the profile, and it accumulates over time. I think those concentrations can be much higher, but it can be also much more difficult to remedy that, I think. Cost, societal cost. As we have more people and most of the population, I forget the exact statistic, but I think something in the order of 70% of the United States population, no, 70 to 90% of the United States population, I think, lives within 100 miles of coastal areas in this country. So as those problems and discharge of nutrients from human waste treatment and consumption and development in those areas makes its way to the water bodies, there's more stress in those systems. People in the urban sector increasingly want someone to offset their impact so that they don't have to pay the fee to remedy their nitrogen reduction cost. An example here is the Potomac River from Metro DC. The challenge is that there's a single point source that's contributing over 20 tons of nitrogen per day. And through a denitrification process, it could cost hundreds of millions of dollars to implement these engineering changes. And the cost per unit of nitrogen to remove that nitrate is in the order of 50 to 60 cents per pound with this particular methanol denitrification. The average removal cost across the Chesapeake Bay, Bill, I don't know if you've seen these numbers before, but is in the order of $4 per pound of N. Well, as people see these numbers and the cost of mitigating this nitrate nitrogen coming from wastewater treatment plants, they say, well, wait a minute. What does a farmer pay per pound of fertilizer? Maybe we can get them to offset and we'll do some water quality trading. So these water quality trading pressures are becoming enormous in areas, shifting very quickly to air quality challenges. Nitrous oxide emissions are key. There's a session going on right now that I'm missing. I wish I were at rather than talking to you, although I enjoy your presence and thank you for being here. But I just can't keep up with this. It's moving so rapidly. Ammonia emissions, NOx concerns around the world affecting air quality. And one of the concerns here is that we don't understand enough about air quality impacts on human health. And this is something I think we need to take very, very seriously. But the human population in cities and so forth is contributing, I think, more to that than our ammonia evolution from rural areas, although there is long-range transfer that is something we need to pay attention to. Eric Davidson, a friend of mine from graduate school, has generated a report in 2009 that indicated looking at manure inputs and fertilizer inputs and modeling nitrous oxide emissions since 1860, that he could account for nitrous oxide concentration increases in the atmosphere almost directly using his hindsight approach, strictly from manure and fertilizer input increases over that period of time. But I would remind people there's been a 148% increase in fertilizer nitrogen consumption and an 18% increase over these respective years in nitrous oxide concentration. Would it be great if we could develop a technology to block nitrous oxide emission and have everything go completely to N2 where we would be benign in our effects in the atmosphere? That's pie in the sky dream, but I think across that continuum we have many opportunities to initiate change that are going to reduce that impact. Well, what stepped up the pressures in this area is that in 2009, EPA issued an endangerment finding suggesting that they do need to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. This is coming home to roost on most industry across this country and putting increased pressures on agriculture. But I thought I'd just mention real quickly, with respect to global greenhouse gas emissions, nitrous oxide emissions globally account for 7.9% of our CO2 equivalent emissions across the globe. And in the U.S., 4.6%, okay? But because of the global warming potential of nitrous oxide, we have a great deal of increased focus in that area. Now, all of agriculture contributes 6% of total greenhouse gases, according to the latest EPA inventory. And 3.6% of all greenhouse gases are attributed to agricultural soil management, nitrous oxide emissions, which includes those from fertilizer and nitrogen inputs. So proportionally, it's not large, but in the political and social arena, it's huge. The Climate Action Reserve, who's been involved in developing many protocols for mitigation of pollution, has gone through a scoping process, and they suggest that cropland and nutrient management are the top two low-hanging fruit that they could work on in developing protocols. Just this past week, I met with them and other people in Washington, D.C. to review what we currently know and what we think we could do with protocols in developing mitigation approaches to nitrous oxide emissions. But these processes are actually following work that I first became aware of in Alberta, Canada in 2008. And I believe Dr. Brulsema reported yesterday that Alberta now has accepted this protocol. He's working on development of the science to support and investigate the potential for a protocol in Eastern Canada. And all of these protocol scoping meetings are combining with a generation of new data and an better understanding of our management influence on nitrous oxide emissions, which means we are learning new management opportunities. Unfortunately, some of the people that are developing models to predict these nitrous oxide emissions, because it's exceedingly difficult and expensive to quantify this at a farm scale, I'm concerned that some of these models do not take into account the latest management technologies. And so we have to make sure as we work with these technologies, we generate these reports, we get them in the peer-reviewed literature so they can become part of this process and implemented into these models that will help us know where to grab and minimize our impact. Now, coming to the conclusion of my presentation, I would like to say all of us in this room probably are committed to improving nitrogen use efficiency and effectiveness. But one key way to do that is to make sure we are not using surplus nitrogen. And as indicated by Vrong van Groningen, and I know, Tom, you pronounce this differently, and I apologize to those of you who understand how the name should be pronounced, but it published a paper in European Journal of Soil Science, which I think captures the essence of our need, is that within certain bounds of the total crop nitrogen need on kilograms of nitrogen per hectare or above ground nitrogen uptake, the expression of nitrous oxide emissions to those denominators increases only when we get significantly above crop uptake demand. So we have to better sync crop uptake demand with our inputs. So they suggested focusing on optimizing fertilizer nitrogen use efficiency as opposed to just going in and telling everybody to reduce their application rates. Our focus needs to be on developing improved efficiency, and these efforts and pressures to optimize our efficiency are being looked at not only within the science, agriculture science community, but our total food supply chain is considering ways to measure sustainability. And I just mentioned the Keystone Alliance for Sustainable Agriculture has generated some sustainability indicators for these four major crops. They have a trial launch of a footprint calculator that farmers can plug into. And last week, I guess it's 2 weeks ago, I read in the paper where Walmart is stepping up its approach and trying to leverage to reduce fertilizer and pesticide impacts in food production. And this is resetting the scale, if you will. And many industries like PepsiCo, shown here, are developing their own sustainability indicators. And in California, they're doing their own state nitrogen assessment. IP&I has been involved with the nutrient assessment in the U.S. in trying to understand our balances. All of these are ratcheting up our knowledge about where we can make an impact. Now, lastly here, and I'll end because I believe I'm out of time. Got 4 minutes. Thank you. I want to spend just a moment then on this slide, if I got 4 minutes. This slide represents research at Broad Rock Experiment Station, and many of you heard Johnny Johnston speak last night. In the United States, I have searched the literature, and I cannot find a comparable slide that indicates the pool of nitrogen in these different boxes and the transfer of nitrogen via our loss pathways for our major cropping systems. And my thoughts are these. In the absence of this information, how can we develop appropriate strategies? If we don't understand the system, we first have to understand the system to develop an appropriate strategy. And so what we have, as Bill Langstedt was saying, we have policy leading science, when science should be leading and directing policy. So I would invite each of us, where we have a chance, to work with people who have long-term studies to better quantify these compartments so we understand better where we can and should make differences in our management. My personal belief is we can and should improve nitrogen use efficiency effectiveness. Within the industry, we're advocating doing this through a nutrient improvement approach called 4R Nutrient Stewardship. We are strong supporters of that and believe that there are an increasing number of new people coming into agriculture. I understand there were 1,000 students at this conference out of a total 3,800, if I had those numbers correctly, which is very exciting to me. But Glenn, you work in extension. You work a lot with young people, I know, too. But it's exciting to understand that these new people are coming. They're hungry for change, wanting to make an impact. How do we capitalize on their interest and get them plugged into these challenges so they can contribute to the process of helping us make a difference? And I got off a slide here. I'm going to see if I can go back. I want to thank you for your attention, and I want to advertise the International Nitrogen Conference is coming up in New Delhi, India, December 3rd through 7th. A lot of this information will be shared there globally, and our challenges and the opportunities to make a difference for society. And if you haven't considered attending and you still may be able to get a visa in time, I would invite you to consider attending the conference. With that, if there's any time, Matt, I'll be glad to try to answer a few questions.
All right, time for just one question.
Great. Let's listen to the other presenters. Thank you.